This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm Adam Everson, and I'm here talking to today's colloquium speaker, Matt Smith, from the University of Cardiff. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Adam.
So Matt is here to talk to us about dust in nearby galaxies, specifically with Herschel and the SCUBA 2 telescopes. So would you like to tell us about your research?
I primarily look at dust, so this is not dust that you get around your house, but interstellar dust. So it's small particles, and you think of it more like smoke. So it kind of absorbs radiation and hides light in the optical, and then gives it out as heat in the infrared. It's quite cold, so it's normally about 20-odd Kelvin, so we have to look at very long wavelengths to be able to see it. And dust is quite a good tracer of the total interstellar medium, or the amount of gas and other elements between stars. And this is all the raw fuel that's going to form stars in the future. I look at nearby galaxies because we get a really good view. And unlike the Milky Way, where we can only look at kind of the stars in our local neighbourhood and things get very confused because we're within the galaxy, by looking at other galaxies, we can look at the entire picture and see how large-scale factors affect this small-scale star formation.
When we say nearby galaxies, how nearby are these guys?
So I go everything from Andromeda, which is the closest Milky Way-like galaxy to us. That is 785 kiloparsecs away. But then we look at all the way the Virgo cluster. That's actually light we're receiving back when the dinosaurs were around. And that's about 60 megaparsecs away.
And so which kind of instruments do you use to observe?
Mainly, most of my work has revolved around Herschel, which launched just at the beginning of my PhD. And this was a European Space Agency satellite that had the largest mirror in space, 3.5 meters. And that could observe this full far-infrared wavelength range from 60 through to 500 microns. So that's what most of my results are in, and that's given us a huge amount of data. Herschel finished many years ago now, but we're still analysing the data, and it could also look at such large regions of sky. Actually, now what we're doing is following up all these targets with ground-based facilities like the JCMT, which is a telescope built by the UK. It's now owned by a group of East Asian countries, which looks in very narrow windows from the ground because we can have a much bigger dish. You can get much more highly resolved or more sensitive observations. And also ALMA in the future is obviously now taking things with many dishes combined, so you can get really good resolution and sensitivity.
If you're looking at these things quite far away, you're just getting the broad strokes image of the galaxy rather than individual stars or individual star-forming clouds, right?
The advantage of Andromeda is it's so close with the new ground-based stuff. So, for example, I'm leading this new survey on the JCMT, which is looking with SCUBA 2, which is a camera at 450 and 850 microns. We can actually start getting down to resolutions of a giant molecular cloud. In fact, we can start to resolve these things at 450 microns. That works out about 20 parsec resolution. That's the advantage of going to Andromeda, where you're so close, actually. We can start now looking at individual star formation regions compared to things in the Virgo cluster. And actually now, really for the first time, start working out what are these large-scale relations we see in galaxies, how do they relate to these small-scale.
So by studying these individual clouds in external galaxies, you can figure out how the components separate at the interstellar medium within that galaxy and apply it to what you've seen at more distant galaxies?
Exactly. So for example, there's this relation famous in our field called the Schmidt-Cannacutt relation, which relates the amount of star formation to the amount of interstellar medium you have. And globally, we know, you know, it's a power law and it has a slope of 1.4. Yet if you start looking inside a galaxy, you find actually the atomic gas doesn't seem to make much difference. It's all down to molecular gas, so two hydrogens bonded, which are the cold, dense regions. And then you kind of get a slope of 1. But then if you resolve it even further, you start seeing a sublinear slope. And so kind of now the fact we can resolve this, we can start going, well, how do these global relations that kind of seem to apply to all galaxies, how is it built up from all these smaller star formation blocks in different regions of the galaxy? The other advantage is we can, now that we can resolve the different regions, we can start saying, well, how is exactly the star formation changing in, say, like a bulge region of a galaxy, which typically not much star formation's going on, there's not much gas. You've probably got more metals, so anything other than hydrogen and helium. And, you know, you can have a completely different regime in this region compared to a standard kind of disky region where you've kind of got a lot of gas and something more like what we see in our local neighbourhood in our galaxy.
Within the survey you're running on the JCMT, you've got some sort of Milky Way analogue type.
So the one I'm leading on the JCMT is just Andromeda.
Oh, it's just Andromeda. Okay,
it's,
right.
It's a 275-hour survey to just look at Andromeda. Wow. So the atmosphere makes it very challenging.
Okay, yeah.
But obviously we're resolving it a lot more with an 18-meter dish rather than a 15-meter dish. So obviously it gets harder because you're starting resolving it into smaller bits. But also the atmosphere really does hurt you. Compared to Herschel, it's a big problem. And the other thing that's the problem with the atmosphere is because Andromeda's so big, it's 3 degrees wide, which is, to put it in perspective, the moon's about half a degree.
Yes, yeah.
So we actually have trouble with the atmosphere varying quite quickly. We start losing large scales on our ground-based data. So actually we have to use some kind of clever techniques to take low-resolution images from space and fill in the missing information from our ground-based images.
Oh, okay. So that is that from the Herschel telescope? And
yep. So at the 450 microns, the wave band overlaps with Herschel. At the other Scooby 2 band, 850 microns, we actually use Planck, which is a smaller satellite.
And so both of those satellite telescopes have history in Cardiff, where you're from, right?
So we've got, if you walk into our lobby, we've got two giant models.
Yes.
As you walk in. We have an instrumentation group in Cardiff, which specialise in far infrared and submillimeter, from filters to detectors. So we actually built bits of both instruments. And actually that's really nice for us astronomers because, A, we get access to these facilities. In the case of Herschel and Planck, you could anyway, for ESA. But other instruments that they build things for, we get access to. But also they have a lot of knowledge about how to best use the data. So when we come and how we have a problem, or we try and, you know, when we were first helping write the pipelines for Herschel, we could go talk to them, try and solve issues in our maps. And actually that's been really useful.
Oh, cool. The two models in the Cardiff foyer as you walk in, back when the National Astronomy Meeting was here in Manchester in 2012, they came to be displayed and me and Mike Peel drove them back in the van. So
that was a
scary day having this massive van with these.
They're surprisingly expensive.
Yes, they told me how much they cost. And yeah. So your survey on the JCMT, this is going to highlight my ignorance of the geography of Hawaii. Are you being affected by the current volcanic activity? Or are you?
I haven't actually been in touch, but as far as I can tell, no. I mean, so when actually the big explosion happened the other day, I think the ash made it to about 3,000 or 4,000 meters just. And obviously all the telescopes, that's where they, Mauna Kea peak is about 4,000 and or to 4,100 meters. So they're above most of the ash. Normally the wind's blowing in the other direction. I'm not sure for the optical telescopes, but for the JCMT, it can just see through. But actually at the moment, the weather's not that good anyway. And Andromeda's not visible, so I'm hoping by the time...
Oh, right, okay. So
Andromeda becomes visible again in July, August.
Things might have settled down by then.
Hopefully they would have settled down a bit.
And so part of the talk that you've come to give us today mentions that you're going to use gravitational lensing to help you with the research you're trying to do. So would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the advantage, with Andromeda, is the fact you can start getting to resolve these individual giant molecular clouds. We know the universe has changed quite a bit, so at higher redshift... Redshift 1 or 2, so that's something like 11 billion years ago. And the universe was forming a lot more stars than it is today. And obviously the galaxies were smaller because things were probably building up. So the question is, why were they so efficient? What's causing this big burst back then? Now, because they're so far back, you know, they're very small, you can't resolve these disks, you can't perform the same analysis that we can do in our own galaxy or other galaxies. You know, they're normally point sources. With Herschel Atlas, we managed to find a huge sample of lenses. It turns out Herschel data was very effective at finding gravitational lenses. So this is just like a magnifying glass. Things get magnified both in brightness and also resolution. And with ALMA, you have exquisite resolution anyway, but lensing gives you an extra factor of like 10. And actually, so for example, there's a very famous lens, SDP-81, which was done during ALMA commissioning. And they actually get down to 50 parsec, 40 or 50 parsec resolution when you reconstruct the original source. And that's why I'm actually getting quite interested in it, because being a low redshift person, I'm used to being able to resolve these things. Now with these lenses, we can actually start resolving disks at redshift 2 and 3 and doing the same studies that we try and do on nearby galaxies and start seeing what is the difference in their disks. Why are they forming these extra stars? And we've actually just got a large sample of lenses done with the highest resolution ALMA can do. So we haven't done much work on it. It's work kind of we're doing now. But yeah, we should be getting quite a few with like 40 parsec resolution.
So how many sources have you got in?
So at the moment, we've got about six. We got more lenses overall with kind of slightly lower resolution, which we'll start targeting once we choose the best one. But the real highest resolution ones, we've got to about six. And we're kind of concentrating on two now that are the most spectacular.
Yeah, some of the gravitational lens images coming out of ALMA are kind of amazing.
Yeah, we've got one in particular, which we need a name for, but it's almost like a perfect Einstein ring.
Oh,
which is
awesome.
Really spectacular.
So you're going to have a press release with that then?
Hopefully.
Yes, awesome. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Matt.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.